On this episode of Skeptico,
people who weren't following it or outside the United States, this was not an election of Donald Trump. This was a repudiation of Hillary Clinton, of the establishment, of the drain the swamp kind of thing was what really carried the day.
Oh, yeah. I think totally. It was a vote against mainstream media. It was a vote for a lot of skeptical views, even conspiracy views. How many Trump voters do you think are skeptical of the official version of 9/11, for example? Something nobody talks about.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, a little bit of a venture off the path, but not really that far off, because as everyone knows at this point, here in the U.S., we had an election cycle that was truly historic, no matter which side of it you were on. I've heard a lot of people say that Christmas in 2016 reminds them a lot of Christmas in 2001, if you can remember back that far. But after the 9/11 thing, we're all left kind of wondering, what's really going to happen in the world? Where are things going? Felt like there was this major change coming, but we weren't quite sure where it would lead. I think a lot of people have that same sense now. So as you'll hear in this interview, I saw the opportunity with Robert to kind of dive in and talk about some of these political things that are going on, especially with regard to this conspiratorial consciousness science thing that we explore so much on Skeptico. So a little bit of off the path, but not really, especially when you get into the Pizzagate stuff and the fake news stuff and the Podesta stuff and his ties to the UFO stuff. I mean, this is a deep vein to be mined, and we're probably going to mine it. Hey, so before we get to the interview, though, I wanted to let you know one other thing. A few months ago, I did an interview with Dr. Jeff Long, who you all know, NDE researcher, the guy that keeps the largest database of NDEs at nderf.org. And in the process of interviewing Jeff, you know, one of the things we talked about was the persistence of these kind of goofy skeptical arguments about NDE science that keep popping up, even though they've been completely refuted with the science. Like people say, last gasp of a dying brain, lack of oxygen kind of thing. Well, that's something that you know has been totally debunked, but yet it persists. So Dr. Long said, you know, I'd like to do an interview, a show one time on the 5 or 7 top skeptical arguments to NDEs and why those have been refuted. I said, yeah, that's a great idea. That's a great show. Let's do that. So with the help of Jason, who has been a great friend to the show and has really been helping me out a lot lately on doing some final edits on the transcripts and contacting people after the show and doing some other stuff that I really appreciate, with the help of Jason and his wife, we have a little announcement about the thread we're creating where you can come and help us formulate what those questions are, what the top skeptical questions about NDEs are. Here, I'll play this clip for you.
Hello, everyone. One of our regular guests, Dr. Jeffrey Long, is interested in hearing from you, the Skeptico community. Dr. Long would like to know the 5 or 6 materialist objections to the extended consciousness explanation of NDEs that you, the listeners, feel would benefit from further discussion. If you would like to contribute your thoughts, please head over to the Skeptico Forum and in the Skeptico Show folder, find the thread entitled, We Need Your Help. Please share your thoughts there. Once we share them with Dr. Long, we hope to post a response from him in due course. We are looking forward to all your comments. Thanks.
So do check out that thread on the forum. And now on to my interview with Robert Bonomo. Today's guest is a blogger, novelist, anarcho-capitalist, we'll have to ask him about that one, and a part-time tarot reader with a Gnostic bent. Sounds like a great Skeptico guest already, hey? Now, if you visit Robert Bonomo's excellent website, The Cactus Land, you'll be introduced to the wide-ranging interests he has in a lot of his writings, which we're going to talk about today.
but you won't quite be prepared for today's interview because we are going to take it in a slightly different direction. But more on that in 1 second. First off, Robert, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, hi, Alex. It's great to be on the show. I'm a big fan.
Well, thanks. I think we're going to have a interesting, cool discussion because, as I just mentioned a minute ago, you know, we scheduled this interview a little while ago, and I wasn't really thinking about politics and current events when I did it. But then, as the whole world knows, we had this kind of stunning presidential election here in the U.S., stunning no matter what you thought of it, good or bad. And then I started digging into some of the stuff you've written, and I thought, wow, here's an opportunity to talk about this election, this historic election, in some new and different ways that I haven't really heard anyone else talk about. So at the last minute, I said, hey, Robert, you want to do this kind of election political thing? And I'm not really exactly sure where it's going to go. And you're all totally down with it. So that's great.
Yeah, I mean, this election was just fascinating. I mean, it was fun, too. I have to say, I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it. A lot of people complained, but it was just, I think it's a key moment in our history, that election night.
Yeah, I agree. And before I get into that, because one of the first things I want to do is I want to kind of do capture that moment, you know, the election night moment for you and for me as kind of a way into this. But we should probably start with telling folks a little bit more about who you are. So a quick backgrounder on Robert.
Well, I worked in media for many years in advertising, online advertising. And I suppose around 2008, when with the financial crisis, I kind of switched gears. And when I've always wanted to write. And I started blogging, wrote a few novels. And my whole worldview really changed. I think it happened to a lot of people around that time. So I went off in a completely different direction. I had worked in banking a little bit, and so I got really interested in the whole monetary financial system, and that was really the beginning for me.
Now, you also have, I'm reading your bio, you have an MBA, right?
Yeah, I have a master's in management from BU, Boston University.
Which is gonna, I think, play into this story as we get into it. But before that, you're kind of a real typical lefty, right? I mean, you're kind of a...
Oh, total NPR, the New Yorker. I was a happy progressive. The only thing I didn't have was the Volvo.
right.
And yeah, I was thinking about that today. I miss that in a sense because I was so sure I was right.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew what was going on in the world and I knew I was right. There's it's an interesting place to be sometimes.
And now I was listening to an interview I think you did with Miguel's show.
Miguel's show. Yeah, I love that show.
Aeon Byte. And you talked about being postpartisan, which I think is a great term that I think also factors into this story. What does that mean to you, postpartisan?
Oh, I think that's a key because when you're stuck in the whole left-right dynamic paradigm, you really can't see the whole picture. And for me, finding libertarianism, I was able to escape that. So I can look at the Republican-Democratic dynamic as Coke and Pepsi. You move beyond it. You really transcend it. And I think that's a lot of people, what happened to a lot of people in this election, is that they moved beyond that paradigm, the left-right paradigm. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
I definitely agree with you in that sense. And I think that should have been the tip-off to anyone when you said it was a fun election cycle. Because that's kind of how it was for me. It was interesting. I wasn't really even that into it. I wasn't staying on top of it like everyone else. It was just, that's interesting, you know, what's going on. Because I felt so detached from this idea of Republican, Democrat, phony. I was stunned that, you know, that the establishment could be overthrown in this way, but more on that in a minute. So you're also, let's say, you're also a deplorable, right?
Oh, totally.
I mean, you fit into the deplorable. Now, for those who aren't kind of into the election cycle jargon, deplorable became this kind of catchphrase because Hillary in the election characterized Trump supporters, which I'm not, you're not a Trump supporter, but she just characterized anyone who was kind of against her as just being deplorable, you know. And some of the articles that you've written are associated with positions that, you know, people in that camp that wanted to throw those stones at anyone who wasn't with them would fit into that deplorable category. Am I mischaracterizing you, or what would you say?
Not at all. Not at all. That's I'm a true deplorable. I mean, I've been published in InfoWars. You know, Alex Jones published a lot of my articles. So, yeah, I'm a true deplorable.
That would certainly make you a deplorable. So to further support this deplorable label, your work has been published, like you said, kind of all over the place. And some of it has been published on UNZ, UNZ, right? What's the name of the website?
Oh, yeah, Ron UNZ.
Yeah, UNZ Review, is it?
Yes.
Here's what the Anti-Defamation League, so, you know, a Zionist kind of strong lobby thing, had to say about the UNZ Review. And I thought this kind of summed up the deplorable thing just perfectly. He's referring to UNZ, but I think we could, you know, just kind of throw you in the same category. UNZ does not appear to be an anti-Semite, he provides support to the extreme anti-Israeli ideologues, and this is the part I love, and his writings resonate with and are regularly cited by anti-Semites. So this is a deplorable. If the people we oppose like you, then you're deplorable by association, kind of thing.
And, you know, Ron UNZ is a fascinating guy. And he wrote an article in, I believe it was 2010 or 11, about the Ivy League schools and what the breakdown was in the Ivy League schools. And one of his key points in that article, and that article was quoted in the New York Times, Brooks had it as one of the best articles of the year, was basically that the Ivy League schools are 30% white Christian, when white Christians are about 60% of the country. That was one of the key points of the article. And I think Ron UNZ is actually Jewish. I'm not sure. I don't know. But he's not an anti-Semite at all. What he's just talking about is...
That doesn't matter, because he's not. But his writings resonate with... You know, I mean, this is just bizarro land, but we'll talk more about
that. And also, Ron UNZ's articles resonate with a lot of people, even with progressives, because he's such a good writer. And he's very good with numbers, which a lot of progressives aren't. So the points he made were fascinating. And it's so funny that that he would be talked about as an anti-Semite. That's insane.
Yeah, that's crazy. Hey, so let me go back to that opening kind of thing, because I think it's kind of an interesting angle. Where were you on election night for this U.S. election? You weren't even in the States, but I mean, what was it like for you to realize that this kind of stunning to a lot of people, to 99% of people were just stunned that Hillary was defeated, because she was really the preordained candidate. Anyone who follows this from kind of an alt media standpoint just saw this as a total rigged deal from the beginning. There's no way, you know, Hillary and her cronies could ever be overthrown by a populist kind of movement. I mean, again, for people who are totally in the dark about this, but it's easy to forget about this, and especially from people outside the United States, you know, Trump was absolutely despised by his own party, right? His own party was like revolting, saying we're not going to even nominate him, even if he has all the votes and the delegates, we'll still throw him out. We'll have this overthrow at the convention and all this stuff. He was absolutely hated by the Republican Party. Now, it came around in the last few months and said, hey, this is all we got. We got to go for it. But just to give people a sense that this was really, really a stunning, once in a lifetime for me, I've never seen anything like it kind of event. Where were you, Robert? Where were you when you found out? Or were you following it minute by minute? How did that
whole thing? I was following it second by second. And actually, a friend of mine and I were pretty sure Trump was going to win. And we had a position, an options position. So we were watching the markets and the election. So by 3 a.m., we had made a lot of money. And by 9 a.m., when the markets opened, we lost it all.
Wow.
It was a fascinating night to watch the reaction of the mainstream journalists. I think I was watching Fox, and then I went back again and I watched it on CNN and on MSNBC. That moment, that night, is a key moment because we, that night as a country, I really believe we lost our point of reference. No longer will people trust the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. They got it wrong. And the paradigm has shifted. And it's a dangerous moment because who do we trust? I mean, if we want to know what's going on in Syria, for example, where can you go and get something close to objective?
You already knew that you couldn't go to the New York Times and the CNN. You're not saying that. You're just saying that it was kind of became mainstream or more mainstream for people to realize that the gig is up in terms of the fake news. The real fake news, yeah.
The real, exactly. I mean, it got to the point where, sure, I figured this out a long time ago, but all of America figured it out that night. And that's a scary moment.
Yeah, it is a scary moment. It's interesting. Let me tell you, you know, like I kind of alluded to, my election night experience was kind of different in that I had written the whole thing off. I mean, I think forward-looking people like you, I just can't even wrap my arms around how you and let's tip our hat to Alex Jones, you know, who was on top and said, hey, sure, we're going to win. It's going to be a landslide. I was like, that's just crazy talk. There's no way. I couldn't even imagine that happening just because of my life experience. You just, the establishment always wins. You know, the New World Order types, they always get what they want kind of thing. So I had gone to the movies. My wife and I came home from the movies and I was in here on the computer and she goes, you better come in here, Trump. And she is obviously, she's a woman, so she's a big Hillary backer. You better come in here, Trump is winning. I go, don't believe any of that stuff. And then 5 minutes later, she goes, no, you better come in here. So now I'm in and I'm totally engaged. I'm flipping on CNN. I swear to God, the first time I've watched CNN in 3 years, 5 years, I don't know how long. And, you know, now I'm into it. I'm watching it. And the one moment that I found really engaging for me as kind of this conspiratorial skeptico guy, and I wonder if you had any sense of this, but the election is over. It's 99% of the ballots are in Michigan, and they're not calling the state. 99% of the ballots are in Wisconsin. Trump is ahead by tens of thousands of votes. They won't call the state. I'm switching back and forth. You know, even Fox is not calling the state. CNN is not calling the state. None of them are calling it, you know? And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? And they only acknowledge the winner when Hillary conceded. Now, I'm old enough to have been through enough election cycles. There's a race by these people to be the first one to call it. Did you have a sense of what was going on there, or did you ever hear anything about it? It seemed very strange.
I was very confused when Podesta came out. That was a surreal moment. That Podesta moment.
Explain to people.
So when it looked really bad, and like you said, the networks were just some networks. If you added up what all the networks had called, it looked like he won, but no network had called it for Trump. And at that moment, Podesta came out at about, I think it was about 1:30, and said, "We're going to count the votes. We're still waiting. It's not over. We'll be back tomorrow.
Hillary won't be out tonight.
Hillary won't be out tonight, but nothing about we're going to lose. We're going to count all the votes. Hillary's with you." And then Podesta leaves. And it was interesting to look at the anchors, and everyone was like, well, what do we do now?
What's the signal? What's the signal, guys? What are we supposed to say?
Yeah, and you could tell they didn't know what to say because that's what Trump was supposed to have done. It was like role reversal. That was a bizarre moment. And I read what happened, I think, is Obama then called Hillary and pushed her to call Trump. There was a story about that Obama said, look, it's over. You've got to make the call. So then Hillary called Trump. And then as Trump appears on the stage, Fox finally called Pennsylvania. So Fox got it in about 10 seconds before Trump started talking.
Yeah, yeah. And again, folks, I mean, there's 99. They're saying, I remember the guy from CNN who is trying to like keep a straight face, but he's they had really broken it down, and they had a map of all these states. You know, we won't go into that, assuming people understand the U.S. crazy electoral college thing. But he's going county by county, and he's going, you know, he's saying in no uncertain terms, there is no way that Hillary can make up this gap. There's just, you know, look at this county is the one that's missing. There's no reason to think that the vote is going to go different than it has anywhere else. But he's kind of like, why aren't we calling this state? I mean, this would kind of put him over the top. Why aren't we doing it? So what I heard people kind of allude to is that they were really waiting, like you said, for people inside the Clinton campaign who later it came out and before it came out were very, very well closely and inappropriately tied into the mainstream media to say if they had some kind of trick up their sleeve that they were going to pull, just like the Republicans pulled when they rigged the election, you know, back in 2000 and 2004, you know, which is a whole other story. This is, like we said, this is post-partisan. There's nothing about special about rigging elections. Republicans have been masters at it, but you know, the Democrats have their own skills at it too, I guess.
Yeah, we're in a very strange. I mean, I remember when Trump began speaking, I was a little afraid. Really, I thought, wow, this is like almost like a revolution. I mean, this is regime change in a sense. And it's a scary moment because it's an unstable moment in the world. Instability is not good for the world.
That's been good for the stock market, though, hasn't it?
And can you believe the stock market? What was that about? Just as Podesta begins speaking, the stock market turns around. Remember they stopped it? They stopped trading on the futures. It hit the 5%.
Tell people that story. That's a story that will never come out because we'll never know the answer. But as a guy, you know, Robert, people should know, you know, we should talk about this anarcho-capitalism of yours and your zero hedge interest. And, you know, you are a guy who has that MBA business banking sensibility, you know, not that you were a Goldman Sachs elitist or anything like that.
No, God, but, no.
but it's so different than most of the people that we're talking to in the usual groups we talk to in this kind of Gnostic, spiritual, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's very foreign to come at things from that MBA perspective. So explain that a little bit, the futures trading on the stock market and what happened while the election results are coming in, and then what happened after the market opened.
It's a truly fascinating story that nobody has written about. So just some background. With Brexit, when Brexit actually won, that night there was a lot of selling. There's a big sell-off. So people thought if Trump won, there would be a big sell-off, maybe 5%, maybe even 7%, 8%. Every time
– now, when you say even that, oh, let's even deconstruct that, because who is everybody thought? I mean, that
exactly.
When you
went,
looking at it in retrospect, we have to wonder if that was another – you know, I mean, now both sides, let's acknowledge, we're kind of throwing this fear-mongering. But, you know, part of the fear-mongering is the markets will just melt down if Trump is elected, right? So that was hanging out there, you know. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So the thesis was, my thesis was, there's no way they're going to let the markets fall until Hillary gets in. So they're going to keep this going when good news came out about Hillary, the markets had gone up during the election. And for example, when the first Comey announcement came out, the one about the letter, markets tanked. So the consensus was if Trump wins, there's going to be a big sell-off. So as the first results came in
– sell-off meaning the market is going to go down. It's going to crash.
The market's going to go down. So as folks know, the markets don't trade at night, but there's a futures market that trades on the like, for example, the E-minis on the S&Ps. They work all night. So you can buy and sell futures all night. So as the results begin to come in and it looks pretty good for Hillary – the very, very beginning, the futures went up a little bit. The first bad news, the markets start to really tank. 2% by around 1:30, about that time, the futures market hit 5% down. Now, there's a sort of a rule that when it hits 5% down, they stop trading.
Because it's a futures, it's a thinly traded futures market, overnight market. Everyone knows it's highly speculative. They don't want it to go too out of control until they get the real market open in the morning kind of thing. At least that's the rationalization. That probably makes sense.
Exactly. So it was a very interesting moment. Around 1:30, they came on all the networks and said the futures market have stopped trading. They will reopen during normal trading hours at 9:30.
Doom and gloom has happened. The apocalypse is here. Everything is melting down.
No, I just want to say I took a screenshot of it where they announced that trading will resume at 9:30 a.m. in the morning, and it was down 5%. And I have a screenshot of this. So I felt great. We had options on this, actually puts. So we were like, great, if this opens at 9:30, we can sell the puts and we'll make some money. 3 minutes later, the futures market opened again. And it shot back up. And by 9 in the morning, it was actually positive from the day before. It's very strange what happened that night on the futures market.
What makes it even strange or adds to the mystery is that traditionally the positions that Donald Trump took during the campaign, and people criticize him for not taking too many positions, but it just in general, what he was saying would be generally considered very pro-business, pro-market. So the whole thing that the market was going to melt down if a Republican who's going to cut taxes for corporations is elected was kind of a strange thing to spin from the beginning. They spun it. They actually made it happen. And then when it really did happen, they're like, okay, now, you know, that story has to close its chapter because this is the new reality. Hey, isn't this really good for the markets if corporate tax rates are slashed and, you know, we're going to invest in business and have all this business-friendly kind of environment thing?
Exactly. And that's what, in the final analysis, when I did sort of the autopsy of this trade that went bad, I realized as soon as everyone in the market said, okay, Trump has won, it's time to get out of bonds. If you look at the bond market, it's collapsing. Get out of bonds and get into equities, and quickly.
Right.
And they started very quickly the changing the mem to it's time to get into equities and get out of bonds.
Hey, so let's add, and I love this just kind of freewheeling conversation. It's terrific. I hope people enjoy it and aren't, you know, just kind of dropping off because I did, after the election happened, I did get a number of emails from people who listen to Skeptico regularly and, you know, were like, hey, if you want to move, you can kind of thing. And they had just kind of assumed that who would be for Trump? I can't say I was for Trump, but, you know, Hillary I saw as just a complete extension of the crazy Bush New World Order, red flag, you know, doing kind of stuff. There is no way. I just didn't think it was possible. But I was certainly, I just couldn't even believe, no matter what comes with Trump, and we don't know, I think most people who are alt media folks were just delighted to see that kind of change, that the people really did have the power to make that kind of change, because that's what the election was really about. I mean, people who weren't following it or outside the United States, this was not an election of Donald Trump. This was a repudiation of Hillary Clinton, of the establishment, of telling us what to do, of just kind of making stuff up, of all that crazy stuff that has gone on. I mean, the drain the swamp kind of thing was what really carried the day.
Oh yeah, I think totally. It was a vote against mainstream media. It was a vote for a lot of skeptical views, even conspiracy views.
Exactly.
How many Trump voters do you think are skeptical of the official version of 9/11, for example?
Exactly.
Something nobody talks about. Nobody talks about that.
Totally. Robert, that's what we are going to title this episode, is how truthers defeated Hillary in the election. Because
absolutely,
you know, that's what it's really all about to me. That is the fulcrum point, the 9/11 thing. And it's so funny now, and I want you to speak to this, is one of the movements now that's happening in the establishment media is they're trying to do this other switch now, this alt-right thing. So what you'll hear, folks, if you look into this and just kind of keep your eyes out, you'll hear this alt-right, alt-right. And even my wife has said, have you heard about these alt-right groups? And I saw this just disgusting, you know, neo-Nazi alt-right guy, alt-right guy. What they're trying to equate in your mind is alt-media with alt-right, you know.
Right.
So like on this show, we've had two alt-media guys, James Corbett and Luke Gretkowski. The other guy that a lot of people know that you mentioned and you write for, Alex Jones on InfoWars. If you listen to any of these people, and they're truthers, I'll just take that label right on. They just say 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by some global players to do some global geopolitical kind of craziness that we can't even imagine, and that's the truth, and that's what we should know. Anyone who's a truther cannot be alt-right. You can't be alt-right and be a truther. You can be alt-media, you can be, but you know, Alex Jones is not in favor of George Bush Republican kind of mainstream thing. James Corbett, he is even more, you know, anarchist, but all those people who are in the Bush-hating truthers do not fit this label that they're trying to be tagged with, which is alt-right. What's your view on that? Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic. But let's take James Corbett, for example. James Corbett is a serious libertarian, very intelligent guy, and philosophically very libertarian. There is absolutely nothing racially motivated in what he does. He's an ideological libertarian. So to put him in the same bucket as people who are out-and-out racists, it's really, really – It's just dishonest. It's really dishonest. And even Alex Jones, you can listen to the Alex Jones show. The Alex Jones show is basically just kind of in-your-face infotainment a little bit, but it's basically ideologically libertarian.
Right.
So it's really interesting how libertarians are being, you know, painted as racists, when actually libertarians are the most – they're not at all racists. The progressives, in my opinion, are more racist than the libertarians.
Oh, we could get into that. But you know what? Define for people, you've thrown out this term, an anarcho-capitalist. Explain to people what that means. Break that down and why you put yourself in that category.
Well, if you look at libertarianism, I think most folks are familiar with libertarians. Libertarianism is really an anarcho-capitalist. Capitalism are very similar. Libertarians believe in very small government, sometimes almost no government, total privatization. They see the evil in the world as governments. So, for example, in the 20th century, who were the biggest murderers of people in the 20th century? Governments. So that libertarian or anarcho-capitalist view is, if we limit the size of government, we will limit the amount of violence in the world.
The anarchism thing is still going to be a stumbling block for people. So define what anarchism really means.
This can be difficult because there are two sides to anarchism. There's sort of the leftist anarchism of Bakunin and that part of it, which is more European. But in the American sense, this goes back to Murray Rothbard, Lou Rockwell, for example, would call themselves anarcho-capitalist. So basically, we believe in free markets and very, very, very small government. It's not anarchism in the sense of blowing things up at all. I mean, the fundamental ideas of this type of anarchism is peace and prosperity. And part of the peace part is limited government, because anarchists or libertarians, however you want to call them, really believe that the biggest purveyors of violence in the world are governments.
But with a little bit of an edge, let's acknowledge that.
Oh, yeah.
The one line I like, which I think really sums it up, and you have to think about it deeply, is people should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Absolutely.
I think there's a sensibility there that really, really is profound and deep, and that is that the people give the power to their government. And somehow what an anarchist would say is that we've all sipped too much of the Kool-Aid to think that it's the other way around, that, oh no, the government gives us these rights. And they're like, no, we give the government the right to rule and govern and that kind of stuff.
And libertarians will often talk about sovereignty, personal sovereignty. The sovereignty of the government comes from the people. So, for example, just maybe one simple example, gay marriage. Now, the anarchist view of this is, when did we ever give away our personal freedom to marry who we want to marry to the government? When did this happen? When did I say, yes, the government can decide who I can marry? For the anarchists, this never happened. So why do we have to wait for the government to tell us who we can marry, for example?
Yeah, it's a great one.
So on social issues, most libertarians and anarcho-capitalists are pretty, very, very progressive. And that's where with the alt-right, it gets a little dodgy.
Yes, because it not only gets a little bit dodgy, but it can be completely counter to the ideals and values that you're talking about. Because there really is an alt-right or an extreme right, and there really is some weird stuff going on there, just as there is in the progressive movement. And being post-partisan like you and I are, we're just really not even that interested in that. It's just like, yeah, people have strange ideas. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, the other angle of this that I wanted to play into it, because we touched on it, and this, you know, I resonate with the fact that you're an MBA, and I mean, and you were in the world of business. And it just, to me, when I talk to someone who's really been in the business world, and I had an MBA as well, and had a company and was involved in that stuff, it's a whole different worldview that until you get out of it, you don't even realize that you're in it, because you're so immersed in it, and it just totally so makes sense. And you'll find so many people that you respect and admire who are in there, that then when you get out and you hear some of the things that people say about business people or, you know, capitalists and stuff like that, you're like, what frame of reference do you have? So I thought we should talk about that. And one way we could do it, and this is a character that you brought up in the email that I think you could talk about probably at some length, because I think a lot of people don't even know who he is, or at the very least have a distorted view of who he is. And that's Steve Bannon.
Yeah. Steve Bannon is a fascinating guy, and ideologically. Now, Steve Bannon, I wouldn't call him a libertarian.
No, he's not. No. So I'm not from a business standpoint, because so first of all, who is Steve Bannon? Who was he during the election? Who is he going forward? And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit about his background and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so Steve Bannon right now is the chief strategist for the Trump administration. So he's ideologically the most important person in this administration.
And one of the first people Trump announced as having this yes. high-level official position. So obviously an important pick. And what was he doing right before? What was he doing before that and before he was running Trump's campaign?
So Steve Bannon ran Breitbart News.
Tell folks who Breitbart is.
Breitbart would be, how could we say, very conservative, very edgy, maybe touching the alt-right, but not quite. It's very provocative news, but very kind of in your face and interesting. But I would say if you compare it to, say, something like InfoWars, it's a lot more mainstream than InfoWars is.
And
it's a really interesting site.
Yeah, edgy, in your face, and again, a lot of stuff that the deplorable, the deplorables would find a real home there.
They love Breitbart. Deplorables love Breitbart. It's like, oh my, it's like the New York Times of deplorables.
You're right. But here's the part that I think is that makes it so interesting is Bannon is completely demonized by the mainstream media. I mean, there isn't any gray to this guy. He is, you know, neo-Nazi, homophobic, definitely anti-woman in every way that you could kind of do it. And then, like, if you go, like all these things, if you go and really look and say, gosh, you know, that's just unbelievable that this guy could rise to such a position of power. Who is he really? Oh, well, he's a Harvard MBA, significant experience in Hollywood as a deal maker, which again, if you have any kind of sensibility in business, you're dealing with a whole wide variety of people in Hollywood and in the movie business. Very, very tough business. You know, for someone to succeed in that, you can't exactly be this kind of, you know, just this crazy. It's crazy to think that that kind of person could be this, you know, closet neo-Nazi kind of white supremacist nationalist.
Oh,
it just,
yeah,
it just completely doesn't fit, right?
Steve Bannon worked for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs, which, you know, you could say a lot of bad things about Goldman Sachs, but yeah, it's
a lot of smart people in Goldman Sachs. Hardworking, smart people. You're not going to meet too many idiots who've worked for Goldman Sachs, that's for sure. You know, I think if folks are interested in Steve Bannon, watch some of his films. He has a film I like a lot called Generation Zero. He actually made these films. He directed them. They're documentaries, not very expensive, but you can feel his ideology. And he's very much into that idea of the fourth turning. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, but tell folks a little bit about what fourth turning.
Yeah, the Strauss-Howe theory it's a generational theory. So basically it explains history generationally as a cycle. So, for example, we have the Great Generation, then you have the Silent Generation, then you have the Boomers, and then you have Generation X, and now we're starting again. So according to this theory, it's an economics-based theory. So you have it follows the seasons, spring, summer, fall. According to this theory, we're in winter now. And winter is basically debt. We're just overwhelmed by debt. And we have to clear this debt. And Bannon is very into these ideas. He's a very interesting guy, extremely intelligent, but very, you know, in your face ideologically. I actually like Steve Bannon a lot.
I think he's interesting too. You know, politically, I couldn't really align myself with him because he is on the right, clearly, and he's kind of proudly.
Oh, yeah.
On the right. He's not this kind of post-partisan kind of guy that you and I are. But I think we what I'm kind of bringing out to highlight there is that I think you and I get him. You know, you like him and I like some of his stuff because he just has this business sensibility that we're hoping that Trump will bring to this too, where they're just kind of looking past a lot of the nonsense that you learn to do in business and just say, okay, what are we really focused on here? How do we get the outcome that we want and not go to prison, which is kind of what business people are really.
And one of the things he said that was really interesting with interest rates, almost we have negative interest rates. Has there ever been a better time just to borrow a ton of money at negative interest rates and build stuff? I mean, it's basic economics.
Exactly, exactly. It's the kind of common sense thinking that you just, you know, Obama, who was a CIA creation, and we could get into that whole conspiracy, but I mean, Obama was a CIA extension of the Bush CIA mob that kind of ran things. And, you know, maybe not whether you think he's a good guy or a bad guy, he just wasn't equipped to think at that level, just not trained in that way. And nor was Hillary. I mean, that's just different.
One thing that's really interesting about Obama, what's the largest organization he ever managed before he became president?
Yeah. Wasn't that
I often
like
wonder.
Street group in Chicago of running, you know, protests.
10 volunteers? He managed 10 volunteers?
Right.
And they say, you know, it's really amazing. And like, for example, let's just take Hillary, for example. the most qualified person ever to run for president. That was the meme. But let's look at like what happened in – how was her foreign policy as Secretary of State? I mean, how did that play out? Libya. Has anyone gone to Libya on vacation recently?
Don't even go there because you I don't think you can go there. There's no way to really pull that apart and not wind up in this kind of land of, you know, tossing stuff back and forth.
But I just mean it's just when it goes back to the fact that we really are losing our points of reference. And I really think that's important. Like, you remember when we were kids and we watched Walter Cronkite, for example? You know, maybe you liked him, maybe you didn't like him. But my parents and the people I was around, we all pretty much believed whatever he said. If he said this happened, you know, generally we believed it. But we're at a point now where we have no points of reference.
I don't know that that's a bad thing. I mean, you could argue the opposite, which is that the long tail alt media, which is never been in fuller force and fuller power than it is now, gives me the ability to kind of sample everything. Because Uncle Walter wasn't so great either, you know. And Dan Rather, you know, who followed him, and you know, remember this, Robert, when Dan Rather says, you know, President Kennedy has been shot, and I saw the film, and there it is, his head falling forward, his head falling forward. He's lying. He's part of the whole game. I mean, it was easier back then to manipulate the news because all you had to do is manipulate one or two people at the top and you got the story out.
But it's just that a culture is an operating system. So it's not about the truth. It's about buying into the collective myth. It's very important that we all believe certain things, and that lets the culture work. But when we all pull back and say, we don't believe it anymore, it's a little scary because our culture is really, it's stopped working.
See, I don't share that opinion because of 9/11. And 9/11 makes it impossible to really buy into the culture that we thought we had. And you can get that from other places too. But, you know, just as in this show, you know, I talk so much about biological robots in a meaningless universe and the craziness of the consciousness paradigm. And then the more you dig into it, you go, this is a complete farce. And it's all built on sand, you know, and I don't understand how it's propped up. Well, I think the same translates over to 9/11 when you say, no, wait a minute. You know, Robert, we are in a post 9/11 world. Someone brought down those towers in a way that we don't understand. And that changes everything. Forget about the New York Times. Forget about CNN. Forget about, don't forget about InfoWars because they reported it from the beginning and got it right. For God's sakes, I don't know how that guy does it. But that changes everything.
But what I kind of mean is that I really think this is the culmination of that whole I mean, it took a while for that to cook. You know, it's really interesting. If you look at 1999, we had two interesting films come out, The Matrix and The Truman Show. And then in 2001, we have 9/11. And I think it took about 15 years for all of this kind of sink in. And this is the culmination of we've stopped believing. But you're right. It did. 9/11 is the key. Is the key moment, without a doubt. But it took me a few years to really look at 9/11 and say, you know, this doesn't seem right. In the beginning, I wanted to believe the official story. I really did. I didn't want. I mean, it's difficult. It's really difficult to make that break. And it took people a lot of time, but I think this is the culmination of it.
You know, I picked up this little tidbit from one of the interviews you did that I was listening to, and I immediately had to go Google this because I just couldn't quite believe it and then just couldn't quite wrap my arms around it. But tell people about The Matrix and about Neo's passport.
Yeah, you know, I saw this on YouTube and I didn't believe it either. There's a scene in The Matrix where they bring Neo in and the bad guy is opening his dossier. And you can see his passport. And his passport
You can't see it, though. You can't see it, right? I mean, no one would see it. I don't know how anyone found this, you know? It's one frame in the film.
Exactly. You can't see it if you're watching the film. But somebody must have stopped the frame and focused in on it. And if you really, really look, it shows that it was September 11th, 2001, his passport expires. Now, I didn't believe this. I thought this must be some hoax. But I actually went back, watched the film, and it kind of looks like it is. It's truly bizarre.
It is beyond
bizarre. It's really bizarre. When we talk about synchronicities, there's something there. Something is happening. And this, you know, talking about Miguel Connor, the whole Gnostic idea is really starting to come back, because The Matrix is a Gnostic film. And 9/11 is a Gnostic mythic event.
Talk about that. How would you characterize 9/11 as a Gnostic, esoteric, from an esoteric, Gnostic, mythical perspective?
Okay, yeah. And I've thought about this a lot. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the whole simulation idea. Are we living in a computer simulation? Now, Nick Bostrom wrote that paper that came out in 2003. And that idea is that we're living in a simulation, that it's the reality. There's a reality. The real reality is beyond this reality. 9/11, when people watch 9/11, we see planes hit a building and we see the buildings come down. But a lot of people don't believe it. Now, this is a touchy subject, because I'm not saying it didn't happen. But the fact that we watch it and we don't believe it is a Gnostic event. The reality that we see is not the true reality.
The other Gnostic sensibility is that we are in opposition to this force that is beyond our imagination and yet is right there kind of in front of us kind of thing. If you wanted to have a better example of the ultimate kind of power that you're up against, 9/11 is, you just can't get bigger than that in terms of that event and those buildings, you know, just dustifying in front of your eyes in a way that's completely unexplainable. I mean, if you want to bring it down to a concrete physical level, we have no idea how those buildings could possibly come down. I mean, controlled demolition doesn't explain it. You know, I mean, Judy Wood is out there with her theory trying to say it was some kind of advanced weapon, which again just takes you in a million different directions.
Exactly. Just one more thing about the Gnostic point of view. Just in Gnostic worldview, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, the God who controls this world, he's not a very good God. He's not a nice guy.
He's the bad guy. Yeah, he's the bad. He's creating the illusion. He's creating the Matrix. Yeah,
exactly. And in our current worldview, where we really don't, religion is not that important, God is a little bit the state. It's the world order. And if the world order, we grow up thinking, oh, it's good. We wave the flag, the military, blah, blah, blah. If all of a sudden we start to think that this controlling power is actually killing us, that's a very Gnostic feeling to that. And with the whole simulation idea, this is becoming almost mainstream. I mean, did you see Elon Musk the other day or a couple months ago when he talked about, you know, there's a very good chance we're living in a simulation?
Yes.
So instead of having this God, Yahweh, we have some guy in another planet with some pizza boxes, you know, playing a computer game and, you know, knocking down buildings.
You know who else came out and said it is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the, you know, ordained successor to Carl Sagan. And I just think it's a joke. I mean, we did a whole show on it, and you can relate to it. In one way, it's like for a mainstream science person to make that connection, and Elon Musk is just a business guy. He's just saying stuff just to sell more batteries and that kind of stuff. Who cares? But, you know, for a materialist to kind of go there, it struck me two ways. One is he doesn't understand what he's giving up there. I mean, he's just given up the family jewels in terms of materialism, right? Because if he really thought through, and this sounds kind of arrogant on my part, but it's true, you know, it's like there can be no materialism if the simulation hypothesis is anywhere close to true. He's buying off, he's signing off on the implications of quantum physics and the observer effect that lead us to the inevitable and obvious conclusion that consciousness is real and consciousness has to be factored in from the beginning. But so that's the number one thing that I find stunning. But the other thing is that these guys can't understand the difference between a metaphor.
Exactly.
If the simulation thing is true in any sense, it's metaphorically true at some larger level that we can't even contemplate. It's not true in the sense that, you know, it's happening on some big computer. I mean, it's not like that, you know.
That's such so important. The confusion we have as a culture between myth and history, we confuse them all the time. There's a mythic reality, which comes from consciousness.
Right.
And then there's history, which are things that happen. And we confuse them constantly. If you can separate, like you said, this is a myth. The simulation thing is a beautiful myth. It's an interesting myth, but it's not a reality. But it is interesting what you said about consciousness is if consciousness is fundamental like gravity, it blows that whole thing up. But like you say, these are materialists. So they're looking, we need myths. We can't live without a myth. And this myth fits them. It can become their religion.
Yeah, I don't think they've thought that through. The only intellectually defensible position is the one that they've had for a while, which is consciousness is an illusion. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. You could tell it to a six-year-old and they wouldn't believe it. But it's the only real position that you can kind of hold on to and have it logically fit together and make sense, you know. So then they kind of gravitated towards the panpsychism thing, you know, we'll just spread a little bit of it around here and there. It's, it's conscious. It's just spread out all over the place. That's why you can't see it. That explains it. Yeah. And that doesn't work. And the simulation thing also just, it's just passing the buck. It's like, oh, the consciousness thing. Well, it's, you know, it's created up there in the cloud. You know, it's like, okay, how does that really solve your problem now? Where is it, you know, above the cloud kind of thing? And what does that really mean? And all those kind of things.
Why? And it's interesting. Why are they so terrified of consciousness? They'll do anything to get away from just accepting it. Because we need myths to live. You cannot live in, you know, I'm like, for example, in that zombie article.
So let me say this, and I want you to spend some time now and talk about your books and your various writings that people can find on thecactusland.com. Excellent website. And one of the first pieces you'll see there is an article that you did published February 23rd of 2015, We're All Zombies. And it's really excellent. It's extremely entertaining and extremely thought-provoking and some really funny and accessible ways, though. So tell folks a little bit about We're All Zombies.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated with the whole zombie meme, because you see these people who, from a mythical standpoint, rise from the dead. As in the Christian worldview, people die and their bodies physically, they rise from the dead. But they have this hunger.
An insatiable
appetite. And that's a little bit, I think, a reflection of our culture, because our culture and our myths are not satisfying us. So we keep consuming.
Mindlessly.
Completely mindlessly. And it's in that the bottom of it is the materialism, because we are not machines. You can't just feed us and we'll be happy. We need something else. We need myths. We actually need religion. In a strange sense, we need to be connected to something transcendental. It's part of being human. And we don't have that right now. So in a sense, we are zombies. We consume. We have all sorts of stuff. but there's a hunger in us. And it's a very interesting topic in that we have to find a new myth, but we're not there yet. So we're a world without a myth. And it's a very strange place. And that's a little bit – Joseph Campbell talked a lot about this, that it is a strange moment in history where we really don't have a powerful myth. So a lot of people are falling back on ethnic identities, sexual identities, gender identity, racial identity. It becomes a bit of a myth. The climate, for example, climate change has become a we're looking for something, but it's not satiating us. We're not being filled.
Awesome. I really encourage people to check out that post, that article. It's excellent. Tell folks some of the other stuff that they'll find on the Cactus Land, and also the novels that you've written, which I just dipped into. One of them, the Cactus Land book, I dipped into and is really fascinating. I haven't had a chance to read all of it. And I also understand that I can buy it on Amazon, but I can also get it for free. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. All my on the Cactus Land, you get all my novels as ebooks are for free. So folks can go there and you can download all of them. The last two, I would recommend the last two, Your Love Incomplete, which is sort of a Gnostic journey of awakening and it's an interesting, I think it's a spiritual journey. The Cactus Land is more dystopian. It's sort of a futuristic dystopian, surreal kind of a novel. I think those two are the most interesting. And then I have articles on everything from astrology, tarot, to financial markets, how banking, wide variety of stuff. And right now I'm working on a film on the tarot, the history of the tarot. And I'm actually writing an article, hopefully it'll be done sometime, about this whole simulation myth, how this is a new myth and could be possibly a resurgence of the Gnostic myth through the simulation myth. But I'm still kind of working it out.
Here's what I was going to say, Robert, but before I let you go, I do have to kind of have you commit here. It's going to be fun. I'd like for you to make a prediction. I mean, a lot of people are now, they've sobered up from the election or they've dried their tears from the election. I mean, I really do feel for a lot of the Hillary people, and I'm sure they're still not listening to this show because I know the Hillary people, I know some of them really intimately, and it's a hard thing to get over, and I get that. Yeah. And it's even hard when people like you and I who don't even care that much are just kind of babbling on about it. But what's your prediction? What do you think's going to happen with Trump? Business as usual? I mean, for us truthers, you know, there he is with Mayor Giuliani right up there at the top. I mean, he's the poster boy for truther hater kind of person. You know, he's obviously way, way deep in the 9/11 thing. And so what do you think's going to happen with Trump?
I honestly think the world is in a very, very dangerous moment. If you look at what's going on in Syria, we maybe dodged the bullet there. I'm a little bit agnostic. I think we're in a dangerous moment, and this is the perfect time to start throwing curveballs.
Okay, but what do you specifically think? Come on, let's look into the tarot. Divide the deck, which I'm sure you've done. And what do you think? Let's say you're a money guy and a zero hedge guy. Where would you be on the markets with Trump?
I think when she raises interest rates, which she's going to do, I think it's pretty clear that interest rates are going to be raised. I think we're going to have a massive. I think. If you look at the fourth turning, we're in winter and the worst is yet to come. I really believe that. I think that the second collapse of the financial, the big bubble is the bond bubble, and it's starting to burst. So I think financially, if there's a moment of chaos, it's to come.
There you go. There you have it, folks. I mean, if you do want to switch over and make a buck, I guess you bet against. I don't know how you make money from that, though, really, because that kind of global collapse that you know, a lot of really smart people are predicting. I don't know quite how you hedge against that.
Well, yeah, and I definitely don't want to give financial advice, so don't take my advice about anything. But I mean, I guess you would just take a bond fund and short it or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and then I'll let you go. But the one thing I did find is interesting. You know, it's like we're talking about Bannon, and I'm sure he's super smart. He's a million times smarter than me. And about finances and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know how you announce, you know, it's a great time to borrow $1 trillion for infrastructure. And that's kind of, I mean, I think you'd want to be a little bit more sly about that than go announce to the markets that, you know, I'm going to stiff you for the bill, basically, is what he's saying, kind of thing.
Yeah, basically, he's saying we're going to borrow as much as we can and we'll just have the Fed buy it back. It's free. I mean, if you really understand the financial, what he's saying,
yeah.
It's hysterical.
Yeah, we
can borrow a couple billion. We'll have the Fed buy it. It's free. Come on. Yeah. Let's build stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's well, our guest again has been Robert Bonomo. It's been a great wide-ranging conversation. I'd encourage you to check out his books and his other writings at thecactusland.com. Robert, thanks again so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Alex. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Robert Bonomo for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview. Did the 2016 U.S. presidential election represent the kind of dramatic shift we're talking about here, or is it more just business as usual? So there are already a lot of indications that it could look a lot like the latter. Business as usual, no big change. But a lot of folks keep wondering if there isn't something up the sleeve of the new president that he could actually make some progress on some of these deep state issues that could really lead to some changes. I'm skeptical, but we'll see. What's your opinion? What do you think? Love to hear your thoughts. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can, one, subscribe to the show, get caught up on any of the over 300 past episodes, all available for free, of course, or you can drop me a note, pop on over to the forum, let us hear from you over there. Many, many ways to connect with the show and connect with me, and I hope you take advantage of that. I have a number of great shows coming up and some other projects I'm working on, but at the same time, I'm trying to cut back to this once every other week schedule. So I hope that suits everyone okay. Well, that's going to do it for today. I do thank you for joining me. Until next time, take care and bye for now.
Stay with us for Skeptico.